Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Father Desbois and his team have crisscrossed the countryside in Ukraine in an effort to locate every mass grave and site at which Jews were killed during the Holocaust. To date, they have identified 800 of an estimated 2,000 such locations. They're also collecting artifacts. You'll see some of that in the film, and most significantly, recording video testimony from witnesses, many of whom are speaking publicly for the first time. Father Patrick Desbois is president of the Yahad and Unim Association, which means together in Hebrew and Latin. And if you'd like to find out more about this organization and about Father Desbois' work, we have a sign-up in the lobby, and you also can sign up for email updates. He has devoted his life to confronting anti-Semitism and furthering Catholic-Jewish understanding around the world. He is the advisor to the Vatican on Jewish relations. He's received worldwide acclaim for his work, including honorary doctorates from Hebrew University and awards from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, French President Nicolas Sarkozy, B'nai B'rith, and the ADL. And his book, Holocaust by Bullets, was recently awarded the National Jewish Book Award. We're very honored, as I said, to have Father Desbois with us tonight, all the way from France, and we want to especially thank the Vesper Society for making this program possible. The vision of the Vesper Society, a faith-based organization, is a compassionate world which protects human dignity and enhances human potential. And tonight's program was conceived in collaboration with Sabrina Motley from Vesper Society. So I want to especially thank Sabrina. As I said, we'll begin tonight with a film about Father Desbois' work. It's not an easy film to watch. It's both deeply moving and profoundly disturbing. But then what Father Desbois has been able to do is not easy. Christianity calls for acts of loving kindness and Judaism for mitzvah. Father Desbois is doing both, and he is bearing witness to the unbearable, and for that we owe him a great debt. After the talk, I'll join Father Desbois for a conversation, but we will start now with the film. So, Gordon, if you'll lower the lights, thank you very much. Technical difficulties in the land of media. We need microphones, too. Welcome, Father Desbois.
Thank you. One time per two, it doesn't work. It was your time.
I'm so sorry. I'd love you if you could tell us a little bit about how you were called to this work. I know that you, and I don't think we got to see that part in the film, if you could tell us a little bit about your family background and what drew you to this work.
Yeah, we can wonder why a French priest finally, originally from Burgundy, why I pass 4 months per year in the killing fields of Ukraine and Belarus. Everything comes from a family story. My grandfather was deported in July 42 in a German camp of Soviet prisoners in a small village called Ravaruska, which is actually in Ukraine. He came back alive, and he didn't speak, neither to his wife, neither to his son, who is my father, neither to his daughter. And when I was a child, I didn't understand. I asked him perhaps 100 times what happened there in Ravaruska. And one day he only told me inside the camp it was awful, no food, no drink, but outside the camp it was worse. And me, I was wondering what could be worse than a camp. And it's much later, I became a priest. I went back to Ukraine and I discovered that he was deported in a Jewish village, but every day they saw the shooting as prisoners. So it began as a private family story.
But you're also, but then you became a priest, but that's a whole other story too, because there were people, you came from a family that was not, I mean, it was Catholic, but it was also secular, is that correct?
Yeah, it's a typical Catholic French family.
And
special.
What was their feeling about your deciding to become a priest?
Like every secular family, when they see one is becoming a priest, it's not a good news. But and I was far from thinking I would take care about the Holocaust.
You first went to Africa and you went to India to work with Mother Teresa, is that correct?
Yeah, I was thinking to go as missionary in Africa. And if somebody told me at this moment, the day of my ordination, I would take care of Holocaust, I think I would have resigned immediately.
So it was.
It came back after I was preparing a pilgrimage for students to meet with the Pope in Częstochowa. And we lost our road and we passed near a small village. And I asked, where are we? And somebody told me, we are near Rawaruska, and the village of my grandfather. And so suddenly, between my priesthood, between the execution of the Jews, the genocide, it made one. And I decided to work, to study Holocaust, and after to go back to Ukraine. In the beginning, in Ukraine, nobody wanted to speak. It was a post-Soviet Union. I went to see the mayor, and he told me they killed the Jews in secret. We couldn't know. And me, at that period, I was thinking they really killed the Jews in secret. And I came back one time, two times, three times in Rawaruska, and a new mayor, thanks God, has been elected. And this mayor told me I will make you a surprise, and he brought me in a small hamlet 5 kilometers from Rawaruska called Borove, a one-street village with dogs barking and geese. And at the bottom of the village, I saw 100 farmers, very old people, with their dogs, their animals. And immediately when we went outside of the car, we entered in the forest. The first one, he said, I was a child, I was keeping a cow, and suddenly we saw a German turning and turning with a motorbike, and he went, and we didn't understand why. In fact, this German was looking where to dig the grave. And the day after arrived 3 Germans with a truck with 30 young Jews, the last Jews from the ghetto, and they forced them to dig the grave, 8 meters deep. During the digging, the Germans were buried. You know, the witnesses, they remember all the details. They were buried, so they asked for a table in the village and they put a gramophone to listen to German music. And one was playing harmonica. And he broke his harmonica. And later, with a metallic detector, we found the pieces of harmonica in the ground. Mm. And after they became hungry, and so they were afraid to be poisoned by the village, so they asked 2 chickens that they cooked themselves near the mass grave. I remember I asked to witness how could they eat, and all these Jews were waiting to be shot. And they told me, you know, when you shoot more than 1,000 person in one day, you don't care. And after one German went to see the Jews were digging the mass grave, he said, now you are it's late and you should take rest. You are tired. And they asked them to go outside of the grave and to sit on the grass. And in fact, the German went down in the grave and put explosive under the ground. And after he said to the Jews, now you can go on. And the 30 Jews exploded. And after a woman came back, come from the around like that, the mass grave was like that. And she arrived in the middle and she told me, I was a young girl, 14 years old. And somebody came in my farm and told me, come with a spade. And they asked her, in fact, to climb in the trees and to pick up the pieces of corpse and hide them with branches. And after trucks and trucks and trucks of Jews arrived until the night, and they shot in half a day 1,500 Jews, with only 2 shooters, with carabine Mauser and 3 pushers. Why 3 pushers? Because in July 1941, they established the rule, 1 bullet, 1 Jew, 1 Jew, 1 bullet, to make economy of ammunition. So it means if the people were only injured, they pushed them like that and they buried them alive.
You were surprised that there were witnesses at first? You had not imagined that there were?
Nobody has imagined. Nobody, because in every book it's written it was secret. Nobody has imagined. Nobody knew the Jews were killed in public. And also with the assistance, all these children were forced to do all the black job, I would say, to carry the Jews, to bring back the suits, to sell the suits, to take the gold teeth of the Jews before the shooting, and so on. And these people, they want to speak before to die.
You distinguish, you call these people who, many of whom were requisitioned, you use the term witnesses. They were, in a sense, forced. They were forced into this role. One of your observations, if you could talk about a little bit, we've seen accounts by the perpetrators, we've read some accounts by the survivors, but these accounts are different. How are they different in that sense?
They are not really bystanders. You know, the Nazis, they used the Soviet system. In every municipality, the mayor could make requisition of everybody before the war for anything, to carry fruits, to bring back the cows, for anything. It was called common work. So the Nazis, they use that. They arrive a few days before in the village. They see the mayor, and they say, we want 30 children to dig the grave. We want 2 girls to knit the clothes. We want 2 cookers to cook food, and so on. And they get them in one night, because it was a Soviet system. They used, in fact, the Soviet system of requisition.
And they used the Soviet system, and also, let's speak a little bit about why it took so long for these stories to come out. After the war, the Soviets came in and did their own investigations, right? Yep. So there are vast archives, Soviet archives.
First, after the war, we had only the German archives because it was the Berlin Wall. We could not access the Soviet archives. In fact, the Soviet, immediately the day the village was liberated from the Nazi, they arrived with an NKVD team, and they make a very, very violent investigation, knocking at all the door, looking who was with the German, and opening the graves and taking pictures. And they did that by hand, and it made a volume of paper of 16 million of pages. And you have the 16 million of pages in Holocaust Museum of Washington because they bought a copy in 1992. After the fall of Soviet Union. But nobody read it very consciously because they said it was surely propaganda from Soviet Union, because Soviet Union made a lot of propaganda in many, many ways. So I went to Washington. I have somebody in my team now work full-time in Washington, and I saw that was in these files was, I would say, saying the truth according to what we hear in the villages. I discovered that in a small village called Busk. I have found 14 persons in a street Chechenko, who said that in front of their street, they killed Jews during 6 months. In German archives, nothing, not one line. I went to Washington, and in the same street in 1944, they interviewed 10 witnesses. So I copied these witnesses, this text. I came back to the village and I saw how it was matching house by house. I remember I interviewed Anton Davidovsky and I say, Anton, you say that they killed Jews in front of your house and your cousin was forced to carry dead corpse. But somebody from the same name in 1944, Stepan Davidovsky testimony, he said, oh, it was my uncle. He worked with a Nazi and in fact he testimony to try to save his life. But the Soviet killed him after, and so on and so on. And we could rebuild the connection, I would say, between the Soviet archives and today. But now we are far away from that. Now, from every village, we have the translation of the Soviet archives. We have the translation also of German archives from Justice. And so we build a file for every village before arriving. Now we have completely improved our methodology. It was very intuitive in the beginning.
And part of the reason we don't think about this part of the Holocaust is that there are no buildings, there are no camps. I mean, I think we have to really grasp this kind of physical idea that the land was kind of used in a sense. And when you say that phrase, I think it's a very amazing phrase. You said that the Nazis took beauty away from everything. Yep. They basically vilified the landscape as well as the people. So the land was defaced in that
sense. You know, by example, when you arrive in a city, they look, where are the parks? And now we know, by example, in Kiev, in Lvov, and now we know that under the trees in every park there are Jews. Because they use the landscape. And as they kill the Jews in public, they didn't care to kill them in the very middle of a city. So in Sebastopol, a well-known city in Yalta, they look, where are the parks? There is a big park at the entry of Sebastopol. And immediately when we enter, it's a big city today, 200,000 persons, and we say, surely they killed them there. and it was there.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your process, which is very remarkable, and how you got people, about your team, and how you got people to be comfortable enough to share this, because you talk about the witnesses being between agony and relief. They're relieved that someone will finally hear them because no one has ever asked them. And yet, obviously, to relive these things is extremely painful. Why do they, how are they, how are you able to be able to ask them these questions?
First, we are in Soviet Union, so you must never raise a negative question to get an answer. Otherwise, they remember KGB and they keep silence. I will give you an example. One person, she told me, my brother was forced to keep the Jews in night, and they told him, if one Jew escapes, you are shot. So I didn't ask, did he kill Jews? I said, did he come back alive? He told me, yes. And say, how many Jews tried to escape the first night? Two. So it means he killed him. He killed them. So I didn't say, you killed them. I say, what did he do with the corpse? And say, the corpse. If we put the corpse there and there. And so on. So it's, I will give you another example, much more violent. I was in a family making an interview in a small village. And the woman told me, you should better go in the family in front, because in this family, every night the Jews were sleeping and they were not awaking, they were dead. So we finished this interview, we crossed the street, a woman was standing on a bench, and she says, oh, I know why you come, she told you, that Jews were dying in our house. I say, yes. And she said, I don't understand, they slept in our place, and they every morning they were dead. And I say, even the babies? I say, yes. And she told me, oh, surely they committed suicide. And it means that they killed them, in fact. So I raised only one question. What did you do with the corpse? She told me, oh, I will show you. So she put her boots, her coat, and she brought us at the end of the village where were 17 small mass graves. She brought the corpse herself. We are completely far away from any value. And these people want to speak before to die. And as we are only one question, where are the corpse?
What do you mean we are very far from any, what did you say, one value?
It's post-Soviet Union, it's another world. People told me in our country a life is no more, somebody is no more than a life on a chicken. And even today, it's not an easy life.
When you talk,
you must understand that retired people in Ukraine receive $75 per month, and so no place for them in hospital, nothing.
When you also go into these towns, you have also already done a lot of research, because you use the phrase people were they could feel that they didn't have to be afraid of shocking you, and that gave them a certain sense.
The problem is either you show you are from West, and anytime they see something awful, you make, it's finished the interview. They understand you are not from their world. You are from West. Either you don't move, and you listen, and they speak. I remember I was in Brest-Litovsk. It's in Belarus. And a guy, he was a Soviet prisoner during the war, and he was forced to pack the belongings of the Jews after every shooting in the ghetto. It was a big ghetto. And to sell them by auction at the market with other people, other prisoners. And I raised the question, he was testimonying in the main street near the theater where a lot of students were surrounding and listening. And I asked him, did you work in night or day and night? He told me, no, he worked only on day, because in night the German entered in the ghetto 10 per 10 to rapture the young Jewish girls. I asked my translator, are you sure you translated well? And after, he explained that like very usual. And even here, if you want to know what happened, you have not to move. That's very complicated. And that's the most difficult thing in the interview.
So you say, so if you want to, so you have to basically keep your calm, keep your...
Don't show in your face that you are shocked.
But you also said at some point in some of these interviews that you were so shocked that you actually had to stop the interview.
Yeah, that was in the beginning. That was in the beginning. This book has been done 2-3 years ago. In the beginning, yeah, I was not ready. But I was thinking, if I begin to be to drown in horror, I will never know the truth. And it's an ultimate victory for Hitler and for all. If 60 years after you're afraid to listen, so after you have to bear to listen, to know what happened behind.
Well, I think that's that whole idea of being able to bear to listen. And then when you speak to the public, I mean, they have to be able to bear to listen too. This is not something that we are usually able to talk about.
You know, that's the strength of the mass killers. They kill everybody, even in public, and they know that we try to forget to sleep well, and so they can succeed.
I don't know if you would like to read this aloud. This is. I thought if you could, would you like me to read it, or do you want to read it?
As you want.
You want to read that just from there, accepting the truth to. Because I think it's so beautiful.
Accepting the truth. In my experience, the most difficult part of discovering and gaining personal knowledge of genocide is accepting the truth about what happened. To know, to listen, all the details, while at the same time being able to continue to live a full life without forgetting or hiding what one knows about the past. It is no longer a question of getting stuck with certain impression, of feeling sick, or worse, of remaining immobilized with terror. Terror is part of the strategy of those who commit genocide. Like predators, they create ways of petrifying their victims before killing them. When the Jewish victim got off the train onto the Judenramp, between Auschwitz and Birkenau, they were terrified. When the family of a Holocaust Jew was suddenly taken to the edge of an irrigation well 70 meters deep to be thrown into it, they were paralyzed with fear. Terror can be generated by the sole mention of genocide, by the reading of a book on the subject, or at seeing archives film, or on visiting a former concentration camp. If 60 years later we allow ourselves to be terrified as well, we are allowing the people of the Third Reich an additional victory. Terror can immobilize awareness and hinders the ability to remain responsible, confrontational, and strong enough of the perpetrators of genocide.
Could you speak a little bit? Sometimes you...
I will give you an example to show you. I was 2 weeks ago in Russia, in a small village called Lubavitch, where the Lubavitch come from. And we were near the mass grave and no witness. And suddenly an old man, completely drunk, escaped from the hospital, like in a movie. And the nurse was running behind, like in a movie. And he said, no, I don't want to go, I want to stand. Finally, the nurse resigned and went back and said, if it's that, you will not eat this evening. After 1 hour, he was no more drunk. And in fact, he wanted to speak. First, they shot in front of him 29 persons of his family. His grandmother, his aunt, his mother, everybody. And he was yelling, why they killed my grandmother? They said we were partisans. My grandmother didn't even know what was a partisan. So they killed them behind the church. And after, as he was a teenager, they forced them to watch at the shooting of the Jews, to tell them not to enter in partisan. So he saw everything. And he was very, very violent in speaking and very red. And, you know, we were in the middle of nowhere, at the end of a village, under the rain, with a camera, with somebody who was drunk 1 hour before, escaping from an hospital. And finally he said the truth. And after, he helped us to find 3 or 4 other witnesses. So you see the gap. You are in Lubavitch, normally a village who is well known all over the world. In fact, there is no telephone, no electricity in this village, nothing. You are with a drunk guy, yelling, and here you can get the truth. Either you want to know the truth, either you are very horrified, but whatever happens, and you enter in the genocide machine.
And you were able to keep a sense of judgment away when you hear these stories.
Yeah, because I will give you another story. It was late Christmas, not Catholic Christmas, Orthodox Christmas, not the same day. And we were invited by a family who say, oh, come to our home to eat for Christmas. And it's good for you because our grandfather was at the killing site. So me, I was thinking I will interview them before they drink. So I prefer to begin by the interview with the grandfather before the meal. And the grandfather said that he was forced to dig a grave 4 meter per 4 meter, and that the German didn't want him to watch, but he was watching the shooting behind a bush. So, okay. After he said he was forced a second time because they burnt alive 350 Jewish workers in a sugar factory, and he was forced to take back the corpse outside by the window and to bring them to the cemetery. Okay. And after he said that he was forced a third time to bring all the furniture of the Jewish houses in cart with horses and to sell them by auction in the synagogue. And he explained all the details, that it was difficult because the Jewish houses are two floors. It was needing big ropes to take the furniture by the window. So my cameraman began to say, me, I don't feel well in this family. I don't want to eat with them. I say, it's not a good idea because perhaps he has done much more. Finally, we dressed the table, we began to eat, and a group of teenagers was playing The Mystery of Christmas arrived. So, teenager, it means 16, 17 years old. One was playing Mary, another Jesus, another Joseph, so people that I know in my tradition. And suddenly one was playing Mendel. He arrived with a red nose like that, with a fur coat. And he was saying with a Yiddish accent, I am here to steal all the money of the village. And after arrived Madame Mendel, she was suited in religious Jew with a big bag and with 20 telephone cellular inside. And she said, I have stolen all the cellular of the village. I sell them if you want. It was a pure anti-Semite play. So even here, you must not show anything. Because the grandfather is here, and if he has done 3 things, perhaps he has done 10, and perhaps we can come back in 6 months with new question. So it's that either you want to make you well in your brain and to express what you think, either you want to know the truth. And that is really uneasy.
You said it was a great revelation in one of the, I think it was your interview with a woman named Olena, when you discovered, you said, I discovered that the witnesses knew the victims by name, but that they could do nothing.
I will never forget Olena. She's dead now. We were in a small village, Olesko. Somebody told me, oh, in this village there is no old people. They all died. Always it's false when they say that. I interview a woman like 45 years old, and she told me, no, in here there is no old person. I don't know anybody older than me. Just her neighbor was 91. So we entered in the house of the neighbor. She refused to speak. She was afraid of KGB, afraid of being deported in Siberia because they remember the past. I decided to stand half an hour alone in front of the house, and finally she went out and spoke. She told me, I was in the field, it was summer, I was recolting the corn, and suddenly a truck with Jewish women arrived. And she said, suddenly I was hiding myself afraid of the German, and one woman in the truck knew me because she knew my mother. So she began to yell, Olena, Olena, help me. And she said, more she was yelling, more I was hiding. And she told me she was yelling that until the moment they shot her. And she said, at the end, I ran to see my husband. And he asked me, why are you so white? So you remember, 60 years after, she always listened to that. Olena, Olena, help me. And we saw her, it was my first witness who said that she knew one Jew personally. So it's not an anonymous testimony that they gave. It's a personal, intimate, sometimes very suffering testimony.
And sometimes they haven't told their children?
No. One, it was minus 17, we were in Crimea, and somebody told me, you should go to this family. We entered, she was laying on her bed, very fat, and say, where are the Jews? I don't know. They went on the right, they came back, no. They killed them, I don't know. I say, we are losing our time. And suddenly she became pink, she was hiding her face like that, and she said, in fact, I was fiancé with Itzrik Weisspapir. It was summer, we were in the fields, and looking for watermelon. And we came back, and he went to his house, and I went to my house, and his house was completely destroyed. So he ran to the market, and he saw that her mother was surrounded with all the Jews by the police. So he came to see her back, and see if, you know, we will not marry, because I want to join my family, and I will be shot with them. And he disappeared. And I asked her, because his name was Itzrik Weisspapir, and I asked her, and after what happened, she told me, I married an Ukrainian and he was killed on the front. She told me, I have never been lucky. And all the family was listening behind and discovering that she could have been Madame Weisspapir. She never said that to her family. So most of the time it's like that. It's very intimate souvenir. It's not the Jews. It's not the German. It's the neighbor.
When you think about why you're doing this in this time when there's other genocides going on, have gone on. You've talked about your responsibility, an act of justice towards the dead. Could you talk a little bit about your feeling about that?
First, I realize that today you must know that they are looking for the corpse of the German who are killed in Ukraine. They use the same methodology than us. They call from the churches or in the municipality, and whoever has German in their garden, they send the letter and they take the course and they make wonderful cemeteries. For the Russian who has been killed by the Nazi, there is awful poor cemeteries, and for the Jews, nothing. So in the very beginning, I realized that the dead people were in the same order that was provided by the Third Reich. And I was thinking, we cannot build Europe, we cannot build the modern world on hundreds of mass graves of Jews and Gypsies, because the same for the Gypsies. Because if we do that, what will we say to Rwanda? What will we say to Cambodia? What will we say to Darfur? Say, oh, we had no time to bury the victims. You must understand that only Ukraine is 1.5 million. Belarus, it's 500,000 minimum. Only the three countries we are working on is 2.3 million Jews. I don't count the Gypsies. So if we don't bury them, what can we say to others? Because normally the burial is the first act of humanity.
And you have had dealings with Orthodox rabbis too on that issue of how to, and that's affected your investigations.
Yeah, well. Orthodox rabbi explained us that they consider that all these victims of Holocaust are alive, are tzaddikim, and we must only protect the grave. But today, if we don't do anything, they will build a road, they will build a cultural center, they will build a bank, or smugglers reopen the graves today to look for thief gold. So you imagine the gap between the teaching, the museum, and the statue of the victims.
So, but in the film that we saw, you do respect the...
We try to respect at the maximum the Jewish law so that they will be respected as for what they have been killed.
When you first started to study this subject, you said you went to Yad Vashem in Israel and you took their 7-week course on anti-Semitism?
About anti-Semitism and Holocaust.
But you said you've gone back 7 times to take that course.
Yeah.
Why?
You know, 7, it's a certain number for Christian to try to understand something. But the reality is that it was intuitive, you know. I was not providing to do what I do now. I was trying to understand what my grandfather has seen. And it took me all these seminars to understand. And after I say, okay, now you understood, now you have to go on the ground. Because it didn't happen in Yad Vashem. And I went in Poland, I went in Ukraine, and I saw in which situation was the memory completely absent.
Was the Catholic hierarchy supportive of your desire to do this work?
Yeah, they didn't order it, but they supported it, yeah. The Cardinal of Paris was Lustiger, originally Jew. So he told me, I know the story because my Polish family has been shot. He wrote a letter to the Pope Benedict, who sent a letter to encourage that. And we asked the Cardinal of Ukraine to ask to his priest to help to find witnesses.
And they have, haven't they?
Yeah, without any question. But even if they are not Catholic, if they are Orthodox, or if they are Protestant, they help. You know, there is a Russian proverb. You must understand that Russian are as much Russian or American as American. So something transversal across the Russian mentality. And there is a proverb in Russia who says that the war is over when we give a tomb to the last victim. Mm. So for them to give a burial to the victims is to finish the war. Mm. For them, the war is not over. It's strange, I know, for you, because it's far away, but you must understand that Soviet Union has frozen the time, as the time has begun to move again only since 1992. The time has been frozen.
So, and you could not talk about any of those things during that time?
No, so it's less than 20 years of democracy. You must understand that Holocaust was a taboo in Soviet Union. It was totally outside of the public discourse. For me, for different reason, but it was a complete taboo.
And we were talking a little bit in the green room, since I've been traveling primarily in Poland, that Poland's maybe moved a little faster than Ukraine, because Ukraine is incredibly poor in these rural areas.
The villages are poor. In Ukraine, we are really in Soviet Union. In Poland, you know, Stalin said that the communists was going to the Polish like to treat a cow like a horse.
No, I'll have to ask you about that one. That one later. I want to leave time for people to be able to ask Father Desbois some of your questions. I want to thank you just again for coming here to be with us tonight. So thank you so very, very much. And we do have microphones we record for podcasts, so if I just, this woman right here, and just wait for the microphone to come to you. It's right there.
Hi, Father. Thank you very much. As a genealogist and someone who's a member of the Jewish Genealogy Society of Los Angeles, we're very aware of all the sites. In 2005, I was in Ananyev, north of Odessa. And the first thing the mayor did was walk me over to the field where they had slaughtered the first 400 Jews in one day. The field, I don't think, has been uncovered. How can I get your organization there? and I'd love to talk to you after about context to improve the Stone Age or whatever memorial they have there.
First, we have a website called holocaustbybullets.com. So it's easy to reach us from that. holocaustbybullets.com. And if you know any place that we have not been gone already, north of Odessa, just north is not done. And we have covered only half of the territory of Ukraine. And we receive letters from many, many families. Most of the letters are, we have no news since 41. And also, in which mass grave you think my grandfather, my uncle, my family has been thrown. And if we have details about the shooting of the family, I'll give you an example. We did a village already, and it was finished, supposed to be finished. We have found four mass graves. And suddenly a family wrote to me and said, my mother was not killed in the main shooting. She was killed with four people in the forest. So I went back to the village, and I said, but they didn't kill Jews also in the forest. Oh, we forgot to tell you. Yeah, it's another place. So you must understand that what arrives from a family, it helps us also for the research. To make a memorial, it's not a vocation of my non-profit organization, Yarad Inunum. We take the GPS link Because why? You must understand, we have in front of us a whole continent, because now Russia is opened and the mass killing go until Ossetia, near 100 kilometers from Turkey. So we have to run because the witnesses are not young. So it's a short-term project. We have 5-6 years in front of us maximum according to the length of life in this country. And we have chosen to find the maximum witnesses, maximum of evidences, and we will give the link of the mass grave to any organization who do it seriously. And we are near to find this organization. But if we begin to cover the mass grave, we would be only at the first or the tenth one. And the witnesses are disappearing.
See this gentleman down here? Yeah, just hang on 1 second, just get the microphone to you. There you go.
Yes, I'd like to ask you a question. You know, I was born in eastern Czechoslovakia, and Akcion Barbarossa, the Einsatzgruppen, were trained in my hometown. And most of them were volunteers or Austrians. And the question is, you know, some of these people I went to school with, and they really weren't anti-Semitic when I met them. How on earth would people be able to train just to murder people one bullet at a time? That's is there any explanation to that?
I have no explanation. That's a real deep question. We don't understand.
Because we
Nobody understands. Nobody understands. I will give you the case of the village of Lubavitch. The Nazi, there were a few Russian male who were in the village because most of them were in army, of course. And a few of them refused to go to army. So they were hidden in the village, not to be mobilized by Red Army. When the German arrived, they opened a desk immediately and saw that these people could unregister and become policemen in one day. 1 month after, these 20 policemen killed 500 Jews in the village where their neighbors. We have no answer. We have no answer because these people, some were Nazi, some were not, some were trained, some were not trained. It seems when you give the ability to somebody to kill people without any punishment in the law, you can get it relatively easily.
They were trained 1 week before
Axiom. Yeah, I know. And sometimes they were not trained. But it means that the humanity is very fragile. I think you must understand it was an order to kill, but it's also an authorization to kill. It was legal. When it's legal to kill, imagine in Los Angeles, we say that for 15 days, it's legal to kill, I don't know, the Chinese and or any population. In this case, me, I would let the city because I wouldn't know if I would be a victim or a killer.
Over here, the front row, and then...
I will give you an example, because it was not always big killers like that. We got the example of a grandmother, an Ukrainian grandmother, Greco-Catholic. Her daughter married a Jew. She was against this wedding. War begins, the Jew goes to army, and they have 6 little children. The mother goes to the market, the grandmother brings the 6 little children to the Gestapo to make them shot. And they have been shot. And she went back. It was legal. So she died in her bed 10 years after. It was legal. You must understand, it was legal. So anybody could do it for any private reason. So any small problem could change in a crime. So imagine in your life today with who you have problem. And imagine suddenly tomorrow it's legal to kill them. So you don't sleep the night, say, perhaps I could. And it's like that it happened. It's like that it happened. It was legal. It was legal. So people told me, we killed the neighbor because he wanted the house. They had a beautiful house, so they killed them. As like that.
This gentleman,
they legalized the crime. They legalized the crime. The gypsy is the same. Anybody could kill gypsy. Anybody could kill disabled people. There are three categories that could be killed by anybody. So there were the professional killers from the Einsatzgruppen, the non-professional killers from local police and after anybody.
I have two questions, Father. The first, I'm sort of intrigued why the Soviet Union, since they were probably lost more soldiers in the war against the Nazis than anyone else, why the Holocaust became a taboo subject. And then a personal question. My relatives were from Vitebsk, Belarus, and if you remember anything from that, if you could say something, and then in general, tell people from the website, does it identify the different communities yeah. and perhaps names of people?
So, tell me again your first question.
The first question was, why is it off limits in the Soviet Union?
It was taboo for two reasons. One reason, the first one, is that in the Soviet every country has its own ideology. In Soviet ideology, there was only one big people. And it was unthinkable that a minority has been killed for being a minority, because they were all Soviet. It's a lie of Western countries. Somebody told me 3 weeks ago, a very educated person. There was no minority. No tribe had been killed. I don't say what I think. I say what was said. So for that, for this taboo that seems to you small, but it's not small at all in Soviet Union, even for a Jewish memorial done by the Jews, it was written, here we have killed 1,242 Soviet citizens. Even the Jews could not write Jew. And in the Soviet Commission, they never said Jew. They say in this village, they killed 32 Soviet citizens. First reason. Second reason, in the Soviet ideology, everybody was fighting. No civilian victim. So it's impossible that they killed children and women like that. No. All that is a lie of West. Propaganda. So it stays until now. It stays, unfortunately. And the second thing, in Vitebsk, I have not finished Vitebsk. I've made half of the region. I've made Polotsk, who is part of the region of Vitebsk, and not finished Vitebsk himself, who was the city of Chagall. You must understand that in Belarus it's special, because the Belarusians never accepted the occupation. So they were fighting. So the Nazis were totally upset, if it's not a word with enough, and they burned hundreds and hundreds of villages and killed all the population of these villages. So with the Jews, it was the same. I will give you an example. We interviewed a woman not far from Vitebsk. And it's a family who was hiding 14 Jews. They have been denounced. And a German policeman entered in the house looking for the Jews. And they found one Jew lying under the sofa in the living room. So the gendarme alone, he took the Jew. He made him stood. And he cut all his skin off the back with a knife. And he brought him to shoot him. And the girl, she told me, I was hidden behind the pieces of wood, and I saw that. This night, I decided to enter in the partisan, Soviet partisan, and during the war, I killed myself 40 Germans. So we are completely in another world in Belarus, in a fighting country. And also, there were pockets in Russia that never the German could reach, like the FARC in Colombia. So it means that once a Jew could escape from a shooting, he ran there and he became a partisan. So most of the Jews who are survivors today were partisan. So it's another story. You know, it's another history. Looking from America, everything is the same because it's far, but from near, it's Belarus is Belarus, Ukraine is Ukraine, and Russia is Russia. But Belarus, it's a special story because they were fighters, complete fighters.
So there were these ideologies where things could not be said. For instance, Katyn, the massacre, it did not happen. The Polish officers were not killed by the Soviets because that didn't fit with the ideology. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
This gentleman right there in the red.
When did the mobile trucks start to be used to kill people? Because they decided at some point that it was too inefficient to do it with the Einsatzgruppen.
Yeah, that's That's it's part of the official version, but it's not the real case. The Einsatz group they began the first day of Barbarossa. They entered in Soviet Union the 20 June of 41, and the 23 they begin the killing in Sokal. But also, it's not only the Einsatz group who killed the Jews. For example, in Sokal, they have killed by Wehrmacht. It's complicated. Everybody participated. And these killing units, they stayed until the end of the war. In Russia, they never sent people in camps. Even when Auschwitz was working, Belzec and Sobibor and Treblinka, they didn't send the people from Caucasus in this camp. They killed them on the spot. Don't forget also, there are mobile units, but in capacity of having workers in one day in every village. So it was very easy with them. They didn't need any workers. They got them and went to the next village and got them and so on. So because of this Soviet structure, they could be very quick. Without that, they couldn't do that because they had no worker. They were very small teams.
Is anyone over here in the back over there?
You know, Father, I find your pointing out that it was legal and people act differently legal to be very very interesting. But what it fails to address is the moral issue, okay? Because governments impose legality, and typically religions impose morality. And I just wanted to ask you, when you go around being a Catholic priest and you speak to people and get their stories, do you find that that's a help or a hindrance when it comes to them relating to you what part, if any, good or bad, the local parish played in these genocides?
It's difficult to say because it has never been studied. What we know is that the Greco-Catholic Church welcomed the Nazi, but after realized the crime and that the cardinal asked them to ask to anybody not to participate in any shooting. The Greco-Catholic Church. From the other churches, it depends. It depends. And I have not a real good approach. You know, you must know I am completely concentrated on the crime in every village. And I'm running. And I cannot... many people will be able to work after that because we opened our resource center last week in Paris, and also all these testimonies are in Washington, D.C., in the Holocaust Museum. So, but all the surrounding, anti-Semitism, the place of the government, the interaction, the place of the churches, and that, I cannot tell you. I can tell you a small example. In this village, a priest, an Orthodox priest, was baptizing the Jews to save them. He was hung at the end of the door of the church, and he died like that. I can speak to this one, but I have no study about that. You must understand that we are at the beginning of the history. There are, of course, historians. But if you go to a bookstore and you ask a book about the Holocaust of the Jews in Russia, your bag will not be full.
The Germans couldn't do a grass cooperation of the people around them. They could not do it. The only reason they would be able to do it is because most of the villagers in the cities cooperated.
And I remember the first murder that took place was in Kamenets-Podolsk. And they took from my hometown people that actually were born in Czechoslovakia, but they were from a different town, and they couldn't prove that they lived there for three generations. And they were the first one to be taken to Kamenets-Podolsk and shot. And I understand that the people in Kamenets-Podolsk, the first thing they did is pulling gold teeth and taking all their clothing off. So there was a huge cooperation of the local population, although the Germans didn't treat the Ukrainians that well anyway. But somehow they hated the Jews more so.
Thanks.
I agree, but in Belarus, they were all fighting against the Germans and they killed the Jews. In Ukraine, in Western Ukraine, they had a lot of collaborators and they killed the Jews. In Eastern Ukraine, they had no collaborator or much less, and they killed the Jews. You must understand that they considered that part of the mission with the collaboration or without collaboration. At the end of the war, when the Germans realized they were losing the war, Himmler said, if humanity will not say thank you to me to have destroyed the Russians, they will thank you to me to have killed all the Jews. So it was really, and I would say, a deep motivation of all, most of the German people on the ground. We estimate now that one German per three was on the ground of Soviet Union, killed Jews himself.
Mm. This gentleman back here.
Hi. I'm making a film about one town and one mass grave at Trachtenbrod. And I wonder if... In Trachtenbrod. It's called Sufgievka, is the Ukrainian name. The Yiddish name was Trachtenbrod, near Lutsk.
Near Lutsk?
Yeah. I wonder if you've been in the area. And my other question is, I wonder, in your travels and in your work, what's the general impression that you're getting from young people in Ukraine about the history? Do they know about their history, and how do they react to you and to your work?
I don't meet them so much, because my question is not to meet young people, but old enough to be here at the time of the war. Most of the time, the family listen to what the old grandmother is saying, because we interview people in public. It can be in the street, it can be in the family, but everybody is listening. They are surprised. Most of the time, they don't know. We have also young people who help the grandmother to speak and say, you must speak, you will not be sent to Siberia, it's finished. It depends. I would not have a... But most of the time, they know absolutely nothing of this history, absolutely nothing, because there is no teaching.
There's still no teaching, there's no curriculum.
There is no teaching, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. In West, people speak of Shoah fatigue and all, but in East, we have not begun. It doesn't exist. And so, of course, we have spoken about Holocaust in Western countries, but after, no, nothing. A regular Russian guy doesn't know anything about that. We don't even know the name of the village. When it was a Yiddish village, we don't even know the name of the village before.
Gentleman back there.
They play on cemeteries, on Jewish cemeteries, like they play in a football place.
Sure, there and then there. Go back first.
Yeah, I'm a Holocaust survivor, and I'm just wondering, have you been interviewing people at Babi Yar?
Yeah. We, not so many, because Babi Yar is, as you must know, it's a national problem in all Ukraine, like in every capital.
Yeah, because Babi Yar was one of those graves where Jews and non-Jews were buried together.
And I know. I interviewed four women who were living in a house just above the killing site. So they show the shooting from their own house. But it was a shooting during 3 days, and after shooting two times per week during 6 months. So most of them, they saw only one or two shootings.
Do they have a number? Because they're saying 46,000, 36,000.
But it's a very complicated topic that you raise. We don't know the real number of complete victims, because they killed not only for these 2 days. Yes, we know the number because the Nazi counted. But after they killed people two times per week in the same place, you must understand that it was killing site.
Yeah.
It was killing sight.
Thank you.
Last question over here, gentlemen.
First of all, I wanted to say thank you for all the work that you're doing. My mother is a sole survivor of her family. I took a trip with her to her hometown, Rohatyn in the Ukraine, about 10 years ago, where there are two mass graves. One of which her father was forced to dig and fortunately fled for a while, but wasn't able to escape with his life. And I had a question to know. I wanted to know if you use Yizkor books at all as a resource for information to learn about the histories of the towns.
We use it too. It depends. In some time it's very useful, because Yizkor book as books were done by the Jewish communities about the story of the community. And sometimes there are very few lines about the killings. It depends on them. Yeah, but you must know that we are connecting now with historians from Germany, from America, from Israel. And when we have questions, everybody is running for new sources to understand what happened. Of course, we use Yizkor book also. But for the killing location, only the Soviet Commission gives the location, because they open them and sometimes they make a drawing to say where are the mass graves. But sometimes also in the Soviet Commission, there were only three lines. You know, it's not, nothing is regular. It's really investigation. For example, in Russia, in the territory of Russia, the Soviet commissions are very, very poor. I don't know why. And so we have very, very few documents. And there are very few historians who worked on it. And there are a lot of killing sites on the soil of Russia itself. I just come back from there. And without documents, it's not easy.
So do you think your grandfather would be surprised at what his grandson is doing now with the stories that he finally told you?
I don't know. We will see on the other side. I will have a long discussion with him, I think.
Father Desbois, thank you for your work and for coming. And we'll join you in the lobby. Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.